Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today, making her second appearance, is Anne Wainscott, an assistant professor of political science at St. Louis University in, of all places, St. Louis, Missouri. It is there that Dr. Wainscott specializes in the study of North African and Middle Eastern politics, with a current emphasis on the politics of religious education. She also studies opposition movements to authoritarian regimes in that region and examines the conflict between left-wing secular movements and Islamists. She is currently finishing a book manuscript on how the Moroccan government regulates religion with an eye towards education policy, and that will be the topic of our discussion today. One might wonder, hey, why not wait until the book is out in stores? But Anne will be presenting this material at the American Political Science Association's annual conference this weekend, and I thought it wouldn't be fair if only political science nerds heard this stuff. We want to see her insights reach a broader audience. And speaking of a broader audience, that audience reaches all the way down under to Christchurch, New Zealand, where we have several regular listeners. We want to thank you folks down there, and if you get a chance, drop us a line and say hello. Everyone else is welcome to do the same thing as well by contacting us through our website or emailing me directly at tgill@uw.edu. It is over at our website that you will also see a link to Professor Wainscott's full biography and a select list of writings she has done. So hop on over to www.researchonreligion.org. And welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony. I'm happy to be here.
Well, when we last talked, which, if I'm correct, is about 2 years ago, you were just a mere graduate student at the University of Florida, and one of the few graduate students we've featured on this show. But now you have those fancy PhD initials at the end of your name, and you have a tenure track job at a great university. So how has that transition been?
Well, I guess to say to all the graduate students out there, it really is a wonderful, wonderful change in your professional life. And I've been really fortunate to have access to a lot of resources, and I'm also in a department with many young faculty, so there's a really strong collegiality, and I'm getting a lot of feedback on my research, and also strong social bonds, which I think are really important in the academic profession, because overall the work is so solitary, and some can find it lonely, so I guess I'd just say to graduate students that it's worth the wait.
Yeah, no, it is a good thing. It's a huge burden off your shoulders, and you start to think, oh, wow, I finally did all that graduate work stuff. It's paying off. And so it's on to tenure for you next. You're going to have to be chasing tenure, and that's the next big hurdle there. But I am assuming that your appearance on our podcast was the thing that sealed the deal at St. Louis University.
I agree. Yeah. I think that's right.
That's got to be it. And a second appearance should just nail the tenure thing right down there. So that's what I'm
Well, thank you for having me.
The other nice thing is that, you were able to receive a tenure track job in what is considered to be a pretty difficult academic job market right now. So especially blessed for that. Any words of advice for graduate students out there who are looking for jobs, given that you just went through that gauntlet?
Well, I would say you really just have to be patient. It's a long, slow process. And I think you have to be in it for the long term. I think you have to commit for between 3 and 5 years. I know that's a painful thought for someone at the beginning of that process, but it really does take time, not only for your publications to get accepted and to strengthen your CV, but also for you to network and for you to really develop the qualities that you need to have to present a kind of collegiality instead of a graduate student mentality to people that you're interacting with in the job market. So I'd just say, to any graduate students listening, you really just have to be patient.
Yeah, and speaking of networking, you're out there now at the American Political Science Association conference, and wondering how that process is going.
Well, I mean, You really have to be intentional. I've emailed probably between 10 and 15 scholars in my area over the last few weeks asking if they'll be there, if they're willing to have coffee. And, you know, a great number of them can't get back to you or aren't able to meet, but from time to time you get to meet someone new, and I think that's an important process. Over time, you're going to build up a strong network.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a trick question because we're recording this before you're at APSA.
Well, I knew what you were going for.
Yeah, I played along well. Yeah, we can fool people by pre-recording this stuff. Anyways, we are here not to talk about APSA and having coffee and all that stuff, but we are here to talk today about your paper that you are presenting at the APSA entitled Religious Regulation as Foreign Policy, Morocco's Islamic Diplomacy in West Africa. And that foreign policy part is what's really new here and really caught my eye. This is a really interesting read. And it's an extension of your earlier work that we discussed previously on the podcast, where you focus mostly on the domestic situation. We're talking about Morocco here, and we're going to talk more broadly about Northern and Western Africa. But for the folks who don't know much about Morocco, other than that it was a site for that famous movie Casablanca, give us a little background once again on the country's recent history and what the government looks like today.
Well, the country was a French protectorate from 1912 to 1956 when it got its independence. And since that time, it's been an authoritarian monarchy. They have a constitution, but the constitution doesn't limit the power of the executive, and so it's not really appropriate to refer to the country as a constitutional monarchy. I would say that in recent years, the country has liberalized, but not democratized. So what does that mean? Liberalization refers to the extension of rights. You know, in the Moroccan case, for example, women have gotten more rights to divorce over the last 10 years, so they have more personal freedoms. But there hasn't been a sharing of power at the level of the executive that we've seen in other countries in Africa in particular over the last 20 years. And so I would say it's liberalizing. People are gaining more freedom, but it's not, as far as I can see, moving towards democratic government. It's stabilized as an authoritarian government.
And who's in charge there now? Is there somebody, one particular person, or is it a group, a military junta? Who's running the show?
Well, the king is named Mohammed VI. He took power in 1999 after the death of his father, Hassan II. But he's really surrounded by a group of advisors who are not elected. Sometimes we refer to them as the Mahzan, or the storehouse of central power in Morocco. So they're the people who are really making formative decisions and deciding what direction the country is going to go. There is, aside from those advisors, an elected government. There's a parliament. There are political parties. But those political parties don't have access to the kind of power that they do in liberal democracies. They have a few select areas over which they can legislate. But for the most part, they are following the lead of a set of advisors who are not elected. Once again, this is the reason to not see the country as a democracy.
Okay, and that's going to become important because it's Mohammed VI and his storehouse of power that's going to be leading some of these changes that in foreign policy, which are rather unique. And it's in some ways, it's interesting and surprising for authoritarian regime to be doing this. So it's a very, very interesting country. One of the other things that you wrote about and which we talked about on our last podcast was the tension between Islamist, which you've seen some growth in over the past, oh, I don't know, say two, maybe three decades, and leftists, secular leftists. Give us a quick summary of what's happening there and how the government has dealt with secular leftists and what that means for the Islamists.
Well, leftists, Marxists, socialists, secularists, were really popular in Morocco, as they were around the world in the 1960s, particularly on university campuses. And there was a set of riots in 1965 where university students actually organized alongside workers and just members of the population to really scare what was then a very young monarchy. Hassan II had just taken power several years before the riots. And at that moment, the monarchy realized we have got to get control over this group who could really push for more reform than we want. You have to remember, Morocco had only been independent since 1956, so this is less than 10 years after the founding of their country. There were riots across the country led by university students. with a leftist or a secularist orientation. And so in the coming years, the monarchy undertook a series of reforms that was meant to encourage today what we refer to as Islamists, or individuals with a sense that Islam as a religion can organize politics. There's no need for a separate ideology. You don't need democracy. You don't need communism. What you really need is an Islamic government. The reason that the government wanted to promote Islamism, obviously because leftists are secularists. They don't believe in the involvement of fear. And so the monarchy was thinking, if we encourage people to take on an Islamist orientation, it's going to balance out, or it's going to hold back, it's going to restrain the influence of leftists in our country. However, what the monarchy learned the hard way is that as a leader of a state with resources, you know, the resources to educate, to pave roads, to build institutions, this policy was going to be too strong. And rather than balance the spread of leftism or restrain the spread of leftism, what we saw in Morocco was a virtual growth in Islamism and a real diminishing or weakening of leftism, to the point of it's not very consequential, I'm afraid to say, in the contemporary period. And so in more recent years, and particularly since the beginning of the War on Terror, this policy began in the 1990s, but really picked up speed after that in the atmosphere of the War on Terror, there's been this effort to reverse that policy and to restrain or discourage people from taking on very politically active religious ideologies in the country.
Yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic here, is that you start promoting an alternative to what is seen as a threat, and then that alternative, while it does diminish the perceived threat, also then becomes a thing of its own that might be difficult to control. And so there were some bombings in 2003 in Casablanca, shortly after September 11th, by 2 years or so, and it shocked a lot of folks, and the regime, which was promoting this stuff a decade or so earlier, now has to figure out how to control this. And what does it do in terms of that?
Well, just a word about the Casablanca bombings. Before this time, so before 2003, Moroccans really thought of themselves as exceptional, as excluded, as a country that was not going to have to deal with the forms of Islamic extremism that other countries in the region have had to deal with. And in particular, Morocco's neighbor to the east, Algeria, had a brutal civil war during the 1990s between the military and Islam, an Islamist party that had won a round of an election, and there were fears that it would take power, and so the military stepped in and attempted to, prevent the elections from going forward, a situation that resulted in a civil war and the radicalization of many citizens to take on very extreme Islamist ideologies, and ones in which they were willing to use violence to fight for power. During the 1990s, Morocco is sitting and watching this development in its neighboring country, and the general population, you can still hear this from time to time on the streets in Morocco, we'll talk about, we're not Algeria, we don't have problems like Algeria, we are a very moderate country, we're tolerant, we're open to others, we're not going to have these kinds of violence. And so when bombings took place in 2003 by Moroccan citizens against Jewish and Western targets in Casablanca, the country really went into shock, almost in a way similar to the way the United States had a real period of reckoning after September 11th. And the government, led by the monarchy, really took time to respond to this effort. The bombings happened in May of 2003, and the real policy response didn't come out until April 2004. So nearly an entire year later, the government thought about what is the right policy response. And what they came up with is what they called a multi-dimensional strategy that was intended to really take control of the religious sphere. When they say religious sphere, they mean any of the institutions that the state controls that regulate religion. But they also wanted to expand those institutions. They wanted to have complete control over what scholars call the religious marketplace, or the arena of ideas around religion in the country. And in order to take control of this sphere, they either incorporated religion institutions into the state, or they developed new institutions. So, for example, Morocco had long had councils of religious scholars that advised the monarchy on religious matters. These were reorganized such that there was then local, regional, and national councils. So there was a stronger hierarchy. This is a normal process you would see when anything is bureaucratized or brought into the state bureaucracy. You're going to see the beginning of hierarchy. In addition, the country didn't want to allow people to go to independent private institutions for religious training. And this extends from kindergarten all the way up to senior religious scholars. The state has taken complete control over the forming of religious elites. So in Moroccan public schools, from kindergarten through secondary school, the curriculum that students receive has been, you know, completely regulated by the state. At the same time, institutions of higher learning, colleges, universities that are meant to train religious leaders, those are now all incorporated into the state and are a part of the bureaucracy. So there's now a lot more control over the institutions that shape how people think about their religion.
So that's the kind of stuff that we left off with last time. And the policy seems to be, at least from the vantage point of the Moroccan monarchy or government, seems to be going fairly well. Has there been any changes over the last 2 years since we've talked?
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to get at with the paper I'm presenting this weekend. For many years, I'd say the first decade of this policy, the focus was really on the domestic sphere. How can we shape the beliefs of Moroccan citizens? Over the last 2 years, we've seen this turning outward. How can we take these institutions that were developed to shape Moroccans' religious beliefs and use them to shape other people's religious beliefs, particularly in the region in West Africa? And so particular ways that this is done include, as we just discussed, the training of religious scholars in particular.
Let's before we get to the specifics of this, because this surprised me, and I thought this was just absolutely fascinating, that Morocco is taking its domestic experience and now trying to project it regionally as a foreign policy. It's not something that I would have expected, and maybe I should have been, but I need scholars like you who study this area to make me aware of this kind of thing, because in terms of religious foreign policy, this stuff usually does not hit the radar screen. But when I was reading your paper, it did remind me, or at least it was reminiscent of some earlier efforts dating back to the 1960s, the immediate post-colonial era in the Middle East and Northern Africa, to create a pan-Arab movement, and then a little bit later on, a pan-Islamist movement. So there is, within the Arab world, within the Islamic world more broadly, there has been historical attempts to link countries, to connect in terms of diplomacy and foreign policy with a broad religious ideology or ethnic racial identity. Give us a flavor for that, because I think that'll help contextualize where Morocco's current foreign policy fits into this broader scheme of things.
Well, beginning in the 19th century and extending into the first half of the 20th century, there was a real wrestling going on in the Muslim world about how do we make sense of European advancement in the sciences and their development of political institutions at the same time that we remain true to our identity as Muslims. And so pan-Islam is one of the solutions that grew up in this struggle to try to understand how do we both maintain our own identity while taking a place at the table of nations, while also advancing. So how do we hold firm to who we are while also moving forward as, you know, a productive part of the world? And pan-Islam was the idea that if there was unity among Muslims, perhaps even political unity, that might be one way to counter the hegemonic power of the Europeans. As you can remember, for many centuries, the Ottomans were stronger than the Europeans, and the Europeans were, in fact, afraid of the Ottomans. So I think some people were experiencing this as a shock, right, this shift in influence from Islamic dominance to European dominance. A lot of times, people in America or in Europe think of this as a dynamic that has always been, but Muslims have a very strong memory of when their empires, their dynasties were the most powerful or the most, conducive to the human flourishing and of the sciences and the arts. Now, there were a few experiments in this regard, Egypt and Syria forming the United Arab Republic, and they just didn't turn out well. And so Pan-Islamism as a political unit has not maintained its appeal. However, Saudi Arabia and Iran, to a certain degree, have had a similar policy of not trying to create a political unity, but really trying to use religious links to build support for their own regime. And this has actually resulted in what we call proxy war. So Iran and Saudi Arabia, they're not fighting one another, but they are fighting for influence, particularly across the region that I'm interested in, North and West Africa, by building mosques, by building schools. So in the same way that Morocco is trying to shape its own religious sphere, Saudi Arabia and Iran have been in the region trying to compete with one another, and now Morocco adds a third pole of countries that are trying to shape the religious marketplace of West and North Africa.
And I can see where this might rub Moroccans the wrong way or somebody, because, I mean...
That would be accurate.
Yeah, I mean, pan-Islam, that sounds great. We're all Muslim brothers, and that's great. You know, we have solidarity on that kind of broad base front there. But on the other hand, yeah, it's the Saudi version of this thing, and we're a little bit different, or the Iranian version of things. And, everybody's trying to tell us that we're supposed to be like them, and yeah, we're pretty far away, and we're really quite different. And so I can see how the movements by Saudi Arabia and by Iran are going to have an influence on the thinking of Moroccans, saying, okay, well, if they're doing it, maybe we should do it with our own flavor. And that brings me to this issue of Moroccan Islam. A lot of people out there see Islam as just one religion. It's just the same thing. But in reality, it's really highly variegated. It's a big tent under which really many different flavors of the faith exist. So if you could help us understand what is unique about Moroccan and or West African Islam compared to what people might be thinking about in terms of Saudi Arabia, you know, the home of Mecca and Medina.
Morocco has a very carefully defined religious theological position. This has been a part of their religious policy. So not only have they developed institutions for shaping Islam, but they've defined their own religious belief and practice in a very careful way. And they refer to four and sometimes even five characteristics as the heart of Moroccan Islam. Just to summarize, they refer to themselves as Sunni, Maliki, Ash'ari, and Sufi. And then they privilege a particular reading of the Quran, which is called Warsh. Now, what do these terms mean? Sunni Islam just is meant to differentiate Morocco from Shia Islam. About between 75 and 90% of all Muslims worldwide are Sunni. So this is not a characteristic that really differentiates them from many parts of the Islamic world, but it does emphasize the difference between Iran and Morocco. Second, Malikism is one of the four schools of law in Islam. So which is popular across West Africa and North Africa. So this is going to be a helpful approach because it is something on which Moroccans and West Africans can agree. Their school of law is differentiated once again from Saudi Arabia, from Iran, from the rest of the Islamic world.
Now, let me pause you a minute here and ask you about that school of law, because that comes up a lot, and it's always mm-hmm. tended to confuse me, and I've had to really think about this. You're talking about a religion, and folks here in the United States, a religion is something you do on Sunday before football and all that kind of stuff, but we don't talk about We don't talk about schools of law. And the only time I start talking about schools of law is my son starts thinking, yeah, after college, I'm going to go to Yale Law School. And I'm like, you know, I say, no, you're not. But that's how we think of school of law. And we think of it in a very secular sense. So when you talk about a school of law, and particularly this brand of thinking, Maliki, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, I think that this is particularly difficult for people to understand who are raised in Christian homes or surrounded by Christianity, because the central message of Christianity is the doing away with of the law, right? Judaism is a legal tradition, but Christianity says, you know, that Christ in a sense supersedes the law, that the law is no longer necessary to unite man with God. Islam, like Judaism, is a legal tradition. And when we talk about an Islamic state, what we're really talking about is a state governed by Islamic law. And that's a whole other topic, and would take a whole podcast to really get into in detail. But when you think about any school of law, whether religious or not, they're the sources of the law. What texts are used? What texts are considered as more important than others? What is the hierarchy of those texts? And so Maliki Islam is going to take a particular position. The way Moroccans describe it as it's a particularly flexible and moderate tradition. The founder of the school of law, he didn't know he was founding. What he was asked to do is to codify the daily practice or the common life of people who live in Medina, one of the holy cities of Islam that you mentioned earlier. And so this particular school of law privileges the day-to-day behavior of Muslims. It doesn't make it more important than the text. It's not more important than the Quran. But it does say we can take into account the daily life of people as Muslims and assume that that is a basis of law. So if people have always done something a particular way, and if it's not in contradiction with a text that's considered holy, then we can use it as a basis for a legal ruling in a conflict.
Okay, so that helps out a lot here. So Moroccan Islam is defined by Sunni Maliki school of thought, so it has a different flavor on those different daily behaviors and how it interprets things. And then there's a couple other aspects that differentiate it?
Right, so Probably the least famous term that they use is that they are Ash'ari, that they employ the Ash'ari doctrine in their religious belief and practice. And all this means is that they don't only base their understanding of Islam on text. They also employ human reason. Their thinking about their religion is significant. They don't ignore human reasoning. They want to find a flexibility or a middle path between a literal interpretation of scripture and and relying exclusively on human reason. This is important because there are movements right now in the Islamic world, particularly Salafism, which I'm sure many of your listeners who have heard of, that really, that first of all oppose Ash'arism, but the reason is because they want to hold strictly to an interpretation of scripture and downplay the role of human reason in determining what it means to be a good Muslim.
So it would seem to be a less fundamentalist approach, but more of a growing and changing and thinking type of approach.
Yeah, it has been called moderate. I think that sometimes is not very helpful to understand it, but if you think of it as balancing text and reason, or employing both text and reason to understand what it means to be a religious person.
And then the last thing is something known as Sufi. Other than, there's one more, but the Sufi, explain what that is, and Moroccans tend to feel that they come from a Sufi tradition.
Well, of all of these terms, I think Sufism is the most popular here in America because there are, you know, a number of Sufi communities here in the United States. Sufism just means mystical Islam. So it's actually a very broad umbrella, and it refers to a number of different groups that might be contained in a mystical tradition. This is where a believer really focuses on their relationship with God and of having some sort of experience of God. It might be through the repetition of a phrase, what we call dhikr. It might be through ecstatic dance. You know, there's all these different methods, but the essential difference is that the focus is less on the Islamic community in a political sense, and more on, you know, an individual focusing on their relationship with God. And for the most part, this usually implies or takes on the form of obedience to a sheikh or a Sufi leader. So there's someone who's going to guide a believer into a mystical relationship with God.
Okay. And then you mentioned there's one other aspect that's sometimes included into the quote-unquote Moroccan flavor of Islam, and that's the warsh style of recitation. What does that mean?
All it means is that there are different ways to recite the Quran, as almost as a book of poetry, you know, like as a style of recitation. How long do you hold vowels? You know, how much emphasis do you put on different parts of a word? And Morocco embraces a warsh style of recitation. This is important mainly, I think, because it differentiates itself from, say, the Saudis, who would employ like a haf style of recitation, or a style of recitation that's different in the Gulf. So it's just a way of saying, like, even if you're listening to the Quran, say on the radio or on TV, you can hear whether or not it's coming from someone who's geographically close to where you are. Now, this is going to matter in the contemporary period, because one of the issues that Morocco has faced, obviously, is satellite preachers or satellite TV shows, YouTube preachers, who are becoming popular across the Middle East and North Africa. And what Morocco wants to do is to train its people to hear a particular style of recitation and to recognize it as either alien or acceptable. And so this, I think this is actually the newest plank of the religious policy. I've just started to hear this referred to in the last year or so. And I would say it's an effort to protect Moroccans from internet preachers, we'll talk about this later, but alongside this, Morocco has actually developed a Moroccan Islamic TV station, a Moroccan Islamic radio station, and even its own Quran, written in the style of calligraphy that is known to Moroccan areas. So really just taking control of the avenues through which people can get access and information about their religion, and then trying to shape people's choices when they're alone in their houses on their computers.
Yeah, I find that absolutely fascinating. It's using basically a dialect to demarcate your theology. Say, if you hear things this way, it means this. But if you hear something that way, it means something very different. So that's probably pretty cool. And that relates to the geographic region that you said. And so this is not Morocco that you're just talking about, but the foreign policy of Morocco is extending to countries that have a similar history, similar culture in the West African and Northern African region. First of all, give us a quick idea of what demarcates that boundaries. I know they're probably not very, you know, specific, but what countries are we talking about when you're talking about the West African, North African region?
Yeah, West Africa includes Mali, Mauritania, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Benin, Togo, Niger, and some would say extends even to Nigeria and Chad. Really, once you get beyond Chad or Cameroon, you're talking about Central Africa or East Africa.
Okay. And to what extent do those countries share a similar style of Islam or a similar flavor of Islam?
Well, it depends on the country. A number of those countries are majority Muslim, but even the countries that are not, say Ghana, for example, they all are united by the Maliki school of law. It's very rare for a community anywhere in West or North Africa to be anything other than Maliki, and so that's the reason that's important is because when you are in a particular school of law, you're going to privilege or study a particular set of texts that are foundational to law if you want to be a religious scholar. And the result of that has been a number of the religious scholars across West Africa, but also in North Africa, have studied those texts in Morocco because it had a very famous university, Qadarin University, in Fez, that was founded in the year 1200. It's the oldest continuously operating university in the world. So these educational links, which were facilitated by a shared school of law, have given this long-term relationship between Morocco and the region that it's then going to try to try to employ or to use as part of this foreign policy move that we're discussing.
And so that does bring us to the foreign policy move. And Morocco says, hey, we have this really longstanding university here, so it makes sense for us to, you know, to counter some of the other influences of Saudi Arabia, of Iran, to go out and try to promote our brand of Islam, of Maliki, and a few other aspects of it. How is it doing that?
Well, the primary way is through institutions. So it's taking institutions that already exist in Morocco, that were used to shape the Moroccan domestic religious sphere, and it's reshaping them or re-engineering them so that they are able or capable to shape foreign practice as well. This all got started in 2013 after the civil war kind of started to die down in Mali, and the Moroccans offered, you know, we'll help you deal with the spread of Islamic jihadi sentiment, particularly in your north, by training your religious leaders. And at this time, the institute where they trained imams, I don't even think it had a name yet at this time. It was just the place where Moroccan imams went for training. But once Morocco made this offer to Mali, you know, send us 500 of your imams, we'll train them to specifically go out into Malian communities and discourage the spread of Islamic extremism. Once countries around the region heard about this offer, they started raising their hands and saying, can we join? Can we join? Can we join? And what happened was, I don't think Morocco planned this. I don't think Morocco had a long-term foreign policy goal originally. I do think they were trying to take some sort of symbolic gesture that demonstrated solidarity with the Malians. And that built them goodwill with Americans and other allies in the war on terror. But what ended up happening was so many countries were interested, even up until France. So the former colonizer here has said, will you train our religious leaders? And what Morocco did was it founded a school specifically for training those religious leaders. And it trained three different kinds. Imams are just prayer leaders. They're otherwise lay people. So they don't normally have any kind of specific education. This is special to the Moroccan case. And then there's these two other positions that Morocco is distinctive in having. They're called Morshidin and Morshidat. Just means spiritual guide. It's essentially a social worker, somebody who's attached to the mosque, who when people have problems, they might want counseling, or they might just want to know what is the acceptable Muslim problem. These are people who can counsel Moroccan citizens on these matters. And really, I think the whole point of the establishment of these special positions is that Morocco had no way to shape religious beliefs of its women. Women do not go to mosque for the most part in mosque. They're allowed to go to mosque in Morocco, but they just don't. They're busy at home. They tend to have a lot of children. They might also have full-time jobs. They tend to pray in their homes. And what the country wanted was some way to start to shape women's religious beliefs. So the establishment of this position of Morshidat, or a female spiritual guide, is a way that Moroccan official religious policy can go out and actually go into the homes of citizens and help them with their problems and to be a kind of spokesperson for Moroccan Islam. So that's the first institution that's been significant. And it's named for the king, Muhammad VI. So it's called Muhammad VI Institute for Training of Morshidin and Morshidat, or Spiritual Guides. The second institution that's been important in this process is also named for Muhammad VI, the Muhammad VI Foundation for African Ulama, or Religious Scholars. And this institution was just announced in Ramadan of this year, in July of this year. And what it seeks to do is to bring together religious scholars from all over Africa to what they say is consolidate an Islamic African identity. So we talked earlier about how Morocco had this very well-defined Islamic identity, Maliki, Ash'ari, Sufi, Sunni, you know, with a Warsh style of reading. What Morocco wants to do is make this not just Moroccan Islam identity, but the identity of African Islam. And this is the institution through which it hopes to promote that idea.
Any other pathways that it's promoting this identity?
Well, Morocco has always been really involved in like the hosting of conferences and involvement in international organizations. There's an organization called ESFESCO that takes Moroccan Islamic education teachers and curricula and travels around the region training scholars or training Islamic education teachers to use Moroccan textbooks and the Moroccan approach in their schools. But that's technically an intergovernmental organization. It's not technically a member of the Moroccan state bureaucracy, so it's a little bit different.
Now, one of the things that you just mentioned, and I hadn't picked this up in the paper that you read, but this seems really important, is that this was this role of Morocco going out with its foreign policy and training ulama, training imams, and spreading educational institutions is something that countries came to them. It wasn't something right. that they thought of, you know, sitting in a room saying, okay, now let's go send out our missionaries and we're going to be full force. And that's really has to make this process a lot easier, because one of the questions that I was going to ask was, well, how are other countries in the regions responding to this? I mean, I could see that, yeah, we don't like the Iranians coming in here and forcing stuff on it, but now it's the Moroccans. But it might be more of an accepting type of relationship.
Yeah, and that's actually the central argument of my APSA paper, right? What explains the success of this policy? And the way I define success is all of these countries coming to Morocco and saying, let us join you, you know, take our imam too. It's not normal for any state, whether authoritarian or not, to give up control of any sphere, whether economic, political, or religious. So this abdicating of control, abdicating of power to the Moroccan is really remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to understand, why has this been so successful? So I traveled to Senegal, which is a country that has a very strong relationship with Morocco, partially facilitated by, there's a religious brotherhood, the Tijani, they're Sufi, whose founder passed away in Morocco in the city of Fez. And so members of this brotherhood from all over West Africa have been traveling to Morocco, you know, since 1815 to visit the mausoleum and the shrine that have grown up around the site of his death. And so there's very strong ties between Morocco and Senegal, partially because of this brotherhood. So I traveled to Senegal and I spoke with religious and political elites about Moroccan policy, and the visit really confirmed for me the success of this policy. I'd say the most striking thing I found while I was in the country is that members of the Senegalese religious elite would quote for me Moroccan policy word for word. I don't mean saying we're Maliki, Sufi, Imam. I mean even more specific than that. So, for example, Morocco has been promoting a 12th century Baghdad Sufi by the name of Junaid as a part of its religious policy. So it doesn't just say we're Sufi. It says we're Sufi in the tradition of Imam Junaid. And there's been, you know, literally thousands of Sufi saints in since the founding of Islam in the 7th century. There's a lot of different people they could have chosen, but they chose Imam Junaid. And then while I was in Senegal, people repeatedly said to me, we are Sufi in the tradition of Imam Junaid, or we acknowledge the Warsh school of recitation. And I started to get suspicious. So finally I asked, why did you just say Junaid? And they could even say to me, well, the Moroccans told us, you know, that this is the policy. I mean, there's almost this willingness to promote Moroccan policy word for word by foreign religious elites.
Yeah, I can imagine when you're doing your field work down there, you must have thought, wait a minute, somebody put plants down there, right? You know, they knew I was coming. And so they said, okay, everybody get on board and say Imam Junaid, right? But it's actually coming from the heart. And that's actually kind of cool to find something like that.
Yeah, I think that that's a big thing, right? The people in the region want someone to be a leader on religious matters. They want someone to guide them to deal with this new and terribly disturbing situation with the rise of Islamic extremism. I mean, the situation in Mali was terrifying for people in the region. An Islamic insurgency that cooperated with a separatist movement to take territory from the Malian government. And while I was there, I was reading the newspaper, and somebody had said, "Ce qui menace le Mali menace le Senegal. He who threatens Mali threatens Senegal." There's a strong sense that this threat has already arrived in our neighborhood, and we must do something. And my sense is that religious leaders in across the region are really grateful that the Moroccans are trying to take a leadership role here. And that's what the paper argues. There are these three factors that shape the success of this policy. And I'd say this shared sense of religious identity is the most important of those factors.
Okay, so let's specifically and explicitly go through your three factors that explain this, because I think you do have a really great explanation for this. And now that the more I think about the countries going to Morocco saying, "Hey, help us out with this," it really does make this pan-Islam with a Moroccan flavor type of thing, foreign policy work out even easier. So your three factors are explaining this are what?
So the first factor is a sense among religious and political elites in West Africa that the Moroccan policy has cultural and historic legitimacy. The second factor, the existence of pre-existing institutions. So there are institutions already in the region that could be harnessed to this policy and that could be used to shape a sense of continuity. And third, the combination of religious collaboration with economic cooperation. Do you want me to go into a little bit of explanation on each of these factors?
Yeah, we've covered, I think, to some extent, the cultural and historical legitimacy. They share this Maliki school of thought broadly, and I'm sure there are probably some differences, but there's enough similarities that, you know, faced with a common threat, people say, okay, let's unify over these common themes here. So that would be the cultural historical legitimacy. Tell us about the pre-existing institutional foundations. I think we've touched a little bit on that already too.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this because it mirrors Moroccan domestic policies. So we've already talked about how Morocco already had institutions to regulate religion in its domestic sphere, and that it's turned those outward. Then, in its process of using religion in its foreign policy, it's able to make use of a whole set of other institutions that are already pre-existing in the region. So the best example of this is an organization called the League of Scholars of Morocco and Senegal, Le Ligue des Ulamas du Maroc et du Sénégal. It's an organization that was bringing together the religious scholars of Morocco and Senegal since 1995 to take common positions on issues, to discuss challenges faced by their community, to decide how to train their religious leaders. And some have even suggested that the Muhammad VI Foundation for African Ulama is just a broadening of the mandate of this individual institution. It was run by a guy by the name of Ibrahim, who went by the name Barham Job. And he passed away last year. And so many people see the Muhammad VI Foundation for African Ulama as saying, okay, the main person who is running this Moroccan Senegalese institution has passed away. The time has come now to expand this and make it into a much bigger institution. What this allows Moroccans to do is to make this claim that there's nothing new about their policy, right? That they've long been collaborating with regional Muslims, and this is just an extension or an elaboration of this policy. I was struck in my interviews by how not one person claimed that there had been any change or development in Moroccan religious policy. They all see these efforts to train religious leaders and to bring together African ulama as continuations of existing policies. Whereas for me, I see this as a dramatic change, like this movement from trying to regulate your own religious sphere to trying to regulate neighboring countries' religious sphere. I see this as a dramatic change, but no one in the region sees it that way, and I think that that's because of these pre-existing institutions. A second institution that's worth noting is a lecture series called Durus Hassaniya, the Hassanian Studies, and this is named for King Hassan II, who is Muhammad VI's father, and he started in the early 1960s, I believe 1963, hosting a set of lectures during Ramadan. So what is Ramadan? Ramadan is the month of fasting in the Islamic calendar, where Muslims around the world do not eat, drink, have sex, or smoke from sunup to sundown. What's the result of that? There's a lot of people who are bored from 6 a.m. to about 8 p.m. What better time to broadcast a lecture across the continent on Islam? This is the month when people are really trying to be religious, trying to get back in touch with their faith. And so the king started to host lectures and bring in religious scholars from all around the world. In particular, a number of West African scholars have been invited to attend the lectures or to participate, to actually give the lecture. And so for a long time then, people in the region have been thinking of Morocco as somebody who provides reflection, who tries to push the Islamic community forward, who is willing to deal with contradictory or challenging issues through these lectures.
That is a cool one. And for us scholars, that's kind of neat too, because it seems like we have influence then. Right. One could only think that we could do something like this. And maybe APSA, the American Political Science Association conferences, about bringing that. But
you think that's my next step?
Yeah, I think so.
Research on Religion podcast, second, Darus Hassan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, we can mimic what Morocco is doing. But, you know, alas, maybe we don't have as much influence as we think. But they are having that influence in Morocco, which through these lectures and things like that. And again, it's a what you're seeing, and I think this is absolutely fascinating, is the spread of culture and a unification of culture. We often talk about in broad terms, but you actually see this, you know, at the grassroots of people saying, well, this is how it's done. It's through these lectures, it's through this institute, people coming to Morocco to study at this university or this institute and things like that. The last feature that you talked about that makes all of this more successful is one that really fascinates me, and that is the trade and economic linkages that is occurring at the same time. And I think this is really interesting because it tells us it's not just about religion, it's about broader integration. So tell us about that.
Right, absolutely. There's been a lot of press coverage of Morocco's efforts to build economic ties in West Africa over the last 2 years. This came to international attention because the Moroccan king, Mohammed VI, started to travel in West Africa quite a bit. He took a large trip in 2015, he took another large trip in 2014, and he's just taken another in 2015. Now, why is this significant? The Moroccan king doesn't travel very often, you know? It's a big deal for a king to leave his country, right? Like, it's a demonstration of country he can leave without fear of a coup, and it's these types of meetings tend to result in formal agreements, economic, security, political, or otherwise. And so it's a big deal for a king to visit another country. And in this case, the Moroccan king has been concentrating his visits in West Africa and bringing large groups of businessmen with him to make formal agreements and to spread Moroccan business in the region. Morocco was already a major investor in Africa before the start of this policy. One article I read even suggested that Morocco is the number two investor in Africa after South Africa. So if you're looking only at the African countries who are the biggest investors in the continent, Morocco is already, before the start of this policy, the second largest investor. So it's starting, you know, to make a reference to these pre-existing institutions, it's starting from a really strong position already, but now it's bringing all of the press coverage that would come from an official visit. And then these visits have been long. His visit in Dakar in May of this year was like 7 days. This is extremely long for a royal visit. They tend to be between 2 and 3 days. So there's all these ways that Morocco is signaling that these countries are important to us. They are central to our economic policy, that that we are not just taking our business to West Africa, but we are building mutually beneficial collaboration and cooperation. I just want to read you a quote from the King's Throne Day speech. So this year when he was celebrating the day he took the throne, he gave a speech similar to the American State of the Union, where he talks about the state of political, economic, and social affairs in the country. And the way he framed his economic outreach is really interesting. He said, quote, As regards solidarity, Morocco's strategic diplomacy is aimed at promoting active South-South cooperation, especially with African sister nations. The visits I have paid to a number of African countries have contributed to shaping an economic cooperation model based on shared interests and a desire to improve the quality of life of African citizens. So even when he's talking to his own people, he is emphasizing that his economic collaborations in the region are about mutual benefit. And I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. And I, for me, this resonates really well because some of my earlier work on religious liberty has talked about the linkages that occur between economic issues, trade issues, and how religion plays a factor in this, because it's, you know, people tend to compartmentalize these things all the time, think, well, you know, trade is when you put some widgets on a boat and you sell them to somebody else. It has nothing to do with religion. But I mean, there's this other aspect is that when, you know, two people are trading widgets, they bring some widgets on a boat and somebody buys them, they're interacting on a personal level. And there's a lot of things that we interact with. And one of these is religious faith. And there can be sometimes large barriers to trade based upon these faith. And I've noticed this is that, well, we're not going to trade with Catholics because they're really bad people. But on the other hand, there's opportunities to develop greater human understandings of one another, greater tolerance of one another. And this, in the United States, I've made the argument that this has happened between religion and economic trade, is that you learn that, well, if you don't want to trade with the Catholics or if you don't want to trade with the Quakers, well, then you're not going to do much trading. So why don't you start to learn to live with one another so that you can get their cool widgets and you can have their widgets bought by you and all that kind of stuff. And my question for you, and again, I'm making this broader linkage. You didn't really talk too much about this in your paper, but it's fascinating to me, is do you see greater tolerance, greater understanding, you know, more peaceful relations emanating from this whole process of linking this religious diplomacy with trade and economic diplomacy?
Well, tolerance is a central aspect of the way that Morocco defines itself. I didn't bring it up earlier because I wanted to focus on these theological terms that really define Moroccan Islam, but the other part that perhaps is implicit or unspoken in descriptions of Moroccan, the real desire to promote tolerance, even in its own citizens. So in the Islamic education curriculum over the last few years that has been rewritten, there's been an introduction of a number of different lessons that ask students, like, what does it mean to be open-minded? What does it mean to be tolerant? What does it look like to be tolerant when you interact with someone who you disagree with? What's appropriate dialogue look like with someone who you feel different from? So the first thing I'll say is that tolerance is a central part of Moroccan policy. It's spoken about frequently. It's in the curriculum. The king talks about Morocco as a distinctly moderate and tolerant Islamic country. It's a part of their discourse about themselves. On the practical level, you know, I was just in Senegal, so it's in the front of my mind. But I think one thing to note is that countries in this region are already really tolerant. I was really struck in Senegal when I dealt with very high level religious leaders. They constantly said things like, well, that's okay for them, but it's not what I choose for me. Or, well, this is my belief, but I doesn't have to believe it. It's almost like tolerance. I mean, I don't have a scientific explanation, but I would say that there's already a really strong, particularly in Senegal, that each individual is responsible for his or her own religious choices and that people need to focus on their own religious beliefs. I think some people would say that this is related to the Sufi tradition, which really calls believers to pay attention to their own relationship with God rather than trying to regulate other people's beliefs. Mm-hmm.
Oh, very interesting. Yes, it's stuff that kind of resonates with me. And a lot of folks, I think, out there don't really recognize what's happening in West Africa. When we think about Islam, we think about all the radical elements that might be coming out of certain pockets in the Middle East or Iran or something, and that tends to influence the way that we view the religion in its entirety. And I think a lot of what you are doing with your research is saying, hey, there's a lot of other dynamics that are occurring here, and that there, we really need to be paying attention to those things. Let me finish off with just a final question here, and that is, in looking at this, in your studies over the course of your graduate career, and now over time as an assistant professor, and you're on a mini sabbatical now, as I understand, to do some more of the research and finish off your book manuscript, how have your ideas about Islam, about this region of the world, about the religious world in general, changed in conducting this research?
What a great question. I guess perhaps because of your questions about religious tolerance, religious liberty, I come back to a concern for the destruction of longstanding religious institutions by the state. So I understand why many American policymakers are pleased with the Moroccan policy and see it as, you know, a positive development in the fight against terror. But that's a really narrow way to look at it. Islamic education, or the ways that scholars are formed in Islam, have been consistent, relatively consistent, for over 1,000 years. There's a specific way that people are trained to be religious scholars. It's independent from the state. It's scholar to scholar. You know, Oxford University's whole model of the tutorial system is based on the Islamic model of scholar to student relations. And so over time, you know, as I've observed this policy, I've been, one, disappointed at the lack of sophistication at the level of the policymaker to see the broader implications of this policy. And second, I'm concerned about the destruction of religious institutions in the region so that this policy can go forward. And historically, religious scholars have played a role in restraining the power of the executive. In some cases, religious scholars have even removed leaders because they did not protect Islam in a way that the religious scholars thought was appropriate or acceptable. And so what we're seeing now is this institution that for many years protected the people from despots is being controlled by the state and all the resources of the state. And so it's no longer going to provide this checking power. Noah Feldman has written about this in his work. And I guess my concern is what happens over the long term here. If religious scholars are no longer in these tight relationships with their teachers, but are rather in state-run institutions, yes, maybe we have a somewhat benevolent monarchy in Morocco now, but who's next? And what does that mean for the role of religious scholars in society? I'm very concerned.
Yeah, that is something to take a look at. There seems to be some wonderful aspects of this policy coming out, but as we always know in economics, there's always trade-offs, and there's some downsides to always keep our eye on. And those are some really, really great insights. And we're going to have to keep watching this as it develops, because over just the course of 2 years since we last talked to you, there's been a lot of developments, and I'm sure this is going to change over the next few years. So we're going to keep in touch with you and keep watching your research, and I'm definitely going to have you back on when that book comes out, and we're anticipating it. My guest today has been Anne Wainscott. Anne, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.